From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The stereotype of Sonny Bono is that he was the less talented half of Sonny and Cher, who became a celebrity mayor. On today's Fresh Air, we talked to Sonny Bono about some pretty interesting contributions to rock and roll that you probably didn't even realize he was responsible for. Also today, the sound of Sun Records, the label that launched the careers of Elvis Presley and Jerry Lee Lewis. We talk with Colin Escott, the author of a new history of Sun Records. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie Boys in the Hood. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. After a meeting between Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev and leaders of the G7 today, President Bush said he was convinced that Gorbachev's economic reforms were irreversible. NPR's John Idstey has more.
President Bush has said all along that the U.S. needed to be convinced that reform in the Soviet Union could not be turned back before offering financial aid. Still, despite Mr. Bush's determination about Gorbachev's commitment, only technical aid was offered today by the leaders of the G7. And Mr. Bush suggested no financial assistance was requested by Gorbachev. In a press conference following the meeting, Gorbachev seemed careful not to take on the role of a supplicant.
We shall find our way through this. We shall extricate ourselves, whether you help us or not. That's not the point. And we're not even talking about assistance. We're talking about the new character, new quality of cooperation.
Several of the G7 leaders used similar language, saying this meeting was most significant because it begins the process of integrating the Soviet Union into the world's economy. I'm John Idstey in London.
The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has announced a tentative $66 million settlement for victims of illegal pregnancy discrimination. The settlement, covering more than 13,000 workers, is the largest single cash recovery in the EEOC's history. The lawsuit covers women who worked for the telephone manufacturer Western Electric between 1965 and 1977. The case challenged industry practices that have since been eliminated, including rules that forced women to begin unpaid pregnancy leave at the end of their sixth month of pregnancy. AT&T, which merged with the former Western Electric last year, would pay the settlement if the agreement gets final court approval. The House of Representatives today debated and passed a bill that organized labor had made a top priority. The bill places a ban on hiring permanent workers to replace employees who go on strike. The vote was 247 to 182. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The bill passed easily, but not by a big enough margin to override a promised presidential veto. Supporters of the Workplace Fairness Act said it would protect labor's most basic right, the right to strike. Opponents say the bill would give labor too much power. The bill would close a loophole in the nation's labor laws that says employers can't legally fire workers for striking, but that they can permanently replace them. Unions made the bill a top priority. They argued that the United States' biggest competitors, Germany and Japan, both have similar bans on replacement workers, and unions played hardball. Last month, delegates to the Communication Workers of America Convention voted not to contribute to the campaigns of any member of Congress who didn't back the strikebreaker bill. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
The Dow Industrials lost 5 points today to close at 2,978. This is NPR. The Senate ignored a presidential veto threat today and voted to restore abortion counseling at thousands of federally funded family planning clinics. Like a measure passed by the House, the bill is aimed at voiding Bush administration regulations that prohibit such agencies from giving any information about abortions. Republican opponents of the measure say they have enough votes to sustain a presidential veto. Central American leaders today finished a 3-day summit in El Salvador and expressed optimism that they can build a joint economic future in the region. Tom Gibb reports from San Salvador.
Through a series of summit meetings, the countries in the region are gradually edging towards integration. Panama has now officially joined the original group of five. Eventually, there are hopes to set up a full common market with a regional parliament and even issue a common passport. But there's a long way to go before that. The last attempt at integration ended exactly 22 years ago with a war between El Salvador and Honduras. In particular, all recognize that progress will be difficult while civil wars continue in El Salvador and Guatemala. As at previous meetings, the president's issued a strongly worded statement calling on El Salvador's leftist rebels to disarm. For National Public Radio, this is Tom Gibb in San Salvador.
A Pentagon source said today that analysts have been unable to determine the authenticity of a photo that purports to show three missing Americans in Southeast Asia. The photo has apparently been offered as evidence that Americans who were listed as missing in action during the Vietnam War are still alive. The photo was given to the Pentagon by a private MIA organization in Virginia. The organization refused to say where it came from. The Pentagon source said that experts have been unable to tell who's in the picture or whether it had been doctored. The families of three missing Vietnam-era pilots reportedly say they firmly believe the men are their relatives. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Sonny Bono of Sonny and Cher fame. And you may think of him as someone who needs no introduction, but you'd be wrong. And that's why I've invited Ben Vaughan to introduce Sonny. Ben is a rock musician, producer, collector, and he's one of the people on a forthcoming tribute to Sonny called Bonograph, the classic songs of Sonny Bono interpreted by today's hippest artists. So, Ben, why do you think Sonny Bono is so cool?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with his early years and the work he did behind the scenes before Sonny and Cher broke. He was an assistant for Phil Spector during the golden years of Spector's career. He played percussion on a lot of the songs, and he also worked as an A&R man for Specialty Records, which was a great R&B label that had Little Richard, Larry Williams, and Don and Dewey. And few people know that. He also was a great songwriter back then. He wrote Needles and Pins, which was a big hit for the Searchers, and he wrote She Said Yeah, which the Rolling Stones covered. And, of course, Bang Bang and I Got You, Babe, and everything. And he was a great producer, too. I mean, pardon me if I go on, but what he did with Sonny and Cher really was combine the Spector wall sound with folk rock, which was just emerging at the time. And he was the only person who really had the foresight to bring folk rock even further into pop music with the orchestral things that Spector already had going. So he combined the two, and I Got You, Babe is a perfect example.
So you don't think of Sonny Bono as a joke?
Oh, not at all. Not at all. Of course, he did a whole lot to kind of become a joke with the television show later on and everything. I think he basically lost interest in producing and writing and concentrated on a show business career, which is kind of, you know, a whole different career, the way I see it. But as a musician and a writer and a producer, I think he was very talented.
Okay, thanks, Ben. We're going to meet Sonny in a second. He's got a new autobiography called And the Beat Goes On.
The beat goes on, the beat goes on. Drums keep pounding a rhythm to the brain. La-da-da-da-dee, la-da-da-da-da. Charleston was once the rage, uh-huh.
Sonny Bono, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Let me ask you before we start talking about your career, if you think that there are certain stereotypes that people have of you.
Yes. I think that when a show's on the air and as popular as the Sonny and Cher show is, and you play a character, people and the character's believable, then they believe that character. And so that kind of is who they think you are. And I'm sure that's happened to me.
So who is that? What is the idea people have of you?
Well, I think basically from that show, the character that I played was a straight man, kind of a doofus, the guy that took the brunt of the shots. So I think it was a lovable character and warm and likable, but that was the guy. I think it was a doofus kind of thing.
You're in politics now, but are you writing songs anymore or singing anywhere?
I just built a studio in Palm Springs. I just finished it about a week ago. So all the new things they have musically now is I find fascinating. And where we had to go through so much to produce a record now, you can do it in an office as big as a closet and come out with a symphonic orchestra. So I'd like to dabble in that a little bit. So I built a studio. and I have all the equipment necessary now to produce, so I'll see what comes up. I don't know if my frame of mind's there or if my head's there, because I do enjoy politics.
So have you been writing?
I've written a little bit. I've written a couple songs, but nothing that I'm flipped over, or nothing that I feel clicked like I did when I wrote The Beat Goes On or I Got You. Nothing has hit me like those songs, but maybe it'll come back in.
Well, let's talk about how you got your start. Your idol when you were growing up was Frankie Lane.
And yeah.
I'll confess to you, I was a big fan of his, too. But for me, it was because of, like, Rawhide.
Oh.
I thought he sang that so well, you know.
He got into that.
Yeah, really. So you wrote your first song with Frankie Lane in mind.
Yeah. Frankie Lane was the hot number when I was a kid in school, and he was the kind of real stylist then. So he had this sexy kind of drawl. I patterned everything after Frankie Lane. And when I wanted to sing, I tried to imitate him. And then I wanted to write for Frankie Lane. And by the time I started writing songs, though, Frankie Lane got cold, as we say in show business. So even if he could get a song to him, it didn't mean too much in that day.
So you tried to get a song to him?
Yeah, I did. I in fact did get a song to him. I think what he did, and he liked it very much. I think what he didn't, the part I didn't know, by then I was, 19 or 20, what I didn't know was that he was cold and he couldn't get a recording contract himself, but he owned a record, little independent record company.
And you got a job at that company, and that led you to other record companies.
Well, I was just a writer there. And that was Crystal Records. I was just a songwriter, and they liked all the songs I wrote, so they would see me often and see what I had. And my two stops when I went to Hollywood would be, I used to deliver meat, and I'd stop at two record companies mainly because of my reception. I'd stop at Specialty Records and Crystal Records. And Specialty Records, they liked my material as well. But Specialty was a very successful label. They had Little Richard, Don and Dewey. They had Sam Cooke as a soul stirrer then. He wasn't Sam Cooke. He was one of the soul stirrers. But they were. They had Lloyd Price, Percy Mayfield, all these blues artists. So they were very successful as an independent label, incredibly successful.
Well, when you got a job at Specialty Records, one of your first songs was recorded by the group Don and Dewey, the rhythm and blues duo.
Yeah.
And the song was Coco Joe, and this is a song about the coolest monkey in town.
Yeah, right.
What led you to write the song?
Well, when I was a box boy at a store, they came out with a Coco Joe, and I thought, oh, what a great name, Coco Joe. And so I write this real cute little Calypso song, you know, because Calypso was happening, Belafonte was happening. That was when I was about 17. And then I get to Specialty, and I sing it for Don and Dewey, and they are two raving hardcore blues singers. And so this little, in the jungle there's a monkey, that's the way that I sang it. And they go, in the jungle there's a monkey, bam, you know. And I never heard a song change personality so much in my life. Then later on, the Righteous Brothers recorded it. So actually, that was... probably the first or second song that I wrote.
Well, let's give it a spin.
Okay.
In the jungle, there's a monkey named Coco Joe. The coolest little monkey that you ever know. He don't have a tail like the other monkeys do. He trimmed it, it suede, and it dyed it blue. Coco Joe. Let me tell you about a Coco Joe. With a crazy drink. You should see his walk, it's the funniest thing. He changed the stroll to the monkey swing. Coco Joe, now let me tell you about a Coco Joe. Coco Joe, the coolest little monkey in town. Ah.
was it hard as a 22-year-old producer to work with a kind of wild rhythm and blues group like you were?
No, it was fascinating and fun. I loved it. I loved black music because that was the they were much more liberal about what you wanted to sing or who you were or what your intention was. You know, in that day, Decca and Capitol and Brunswick and RCA were the hot labels. And they just had an attitude about music, and it had to be the certain thing. So it was like the big companies now. You couldn't get in. So, but you went to these black artist labels, you know, they were very flexible, very liberal, and allowed you to be. And so they overcame the music industry because of their attitude, but the black labels were that way. And I first started with Johnny Otis, who let me record on his label, which was Dig Records, you know, and that was the first song I wrote called Ecstasy. So being in that environment with Little Richard and Don and Dewey and Larry Williams, I was in heaven, just absolute heaven.
My guest is Sonny Bono. He's written an autobiography called And the Beat Goes On. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sonny Bono. Now, I'll confess, I just found out this week that you wrote Needles and Pins, and I feel bad. Like I should have known that you wrote that and should have, like, given you credit that for that, you know, in my mind.
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of people, of all the songs I've written, that song, people go, I didn't know you wrote that.
Yeah.
I thought Jackie DeShannon wrote that.
I always just think of The Searchers, you know. I don't even think of Jackie DeShannon.
Yeah, nobody makes the association. So you're not alone.
So did you work on the lyrics?
I worked on it both.
You worked on both?
It was me and Jack Nitzsche, and I had hired Jack Nitzsche to write lead sheets for Specialty Records, and then we became very, very close, and we were like family to his family, and my family hung out together all the time. So we'd talk about music and for days and hours and hours and days and months. That's all we talked about. And Jack could play a piano pretty well, you know, and he had this riff, you know, do-do-do-do-do-do-do, and he just couldn't get it out of mind. He goes, I love this riff. So one night we had nothing to do, so it wasn't planned or preconceived, so we started fooling around, and then Needles and Pins came out, and pretty soon we had a whole song, so we just kind of assembled it, whatever parts we could contribute. So nobody specifically went to lyrics or music.
Well, the question I always wanted answered about Needles and Pins was whether you wrote Needles and Pinza. You know, now it begins-a.
Yeah.
Well, where did that extra syllable come from?
The Pinza. You're always looking for little hooks, what we call hooks when you write, you know. And it also comes from... I kind of always tried to fancy myself as a blues singer, if I could sing, and so blues singers always kind of added these little extra syllables to words or phrase differently. So it was a phrasing that I had. Then Jackie DeShannon heard that phrasing, and she just jumped right on it.
Now, you worked with Phil Spector for a while,
yeah,
as a promo man, and then helping him with production. As a promo man, what was your style in getting airplay on stations? I imagine it wasn't hard to get those records airplay.
It was a piece of cake. I mean, all I had to do was take a record into the station. When I was a promotion man for Philip, he was as hot as he could be, and they couldn't wait to get the next Phil Spector record. So, fortunately, I didn't have to do anything except... get the record to the radio station.
Everyone who's ever worked with Phil Spector has great Phil Spector stories. One that you tell that I especially like in your new book is about how Spector would always practice looking cool. Would you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. Philip was the most unique creature I ever met in my life, especially at that time, because in the early 60s, all the things that were standardized were so embedded, nobody thought in different form other than what was standard, you know. So when you were a singer, you dressed standard. You had the little short suit with the string tie. And the whole world then was pretty conformed. So I get a job with Philip, and I meet this little guy who's just a total nonconformist. His hair was long. He dressed in the most bizarre fashion, and he produced in the most bizarre fashion. Before I wanted to work with Philip because I wanted to see how this guy produced. Up until then, when I produced, I'd have one piano, one guitar, two saxophones or whatever. And here you go in the studio, and there's three pianos lined up. Four guitars lined up, three drummers lined up, and I go, my God, what is going on here? You know, three percussionists, and then a whole sax section. So that was one session. I never saw anything like it in my life. So everything that Philip did was revolutionary. And when he recorded, he'd be wearing sunglasses, and he was just totally cool. And he was always aware that he was a performer. Philip really wanted to be the star. Anybody that sang really was an offshoot of Philip. So he was the star of his label, not the artist. You know, Darlene Love really didn't get that much recognition. Even Ronnie, it was Philip who was the real star. You know, so this guy lived that way. The funniest time I ever had with him trying to impress us was we shopped at the market on Vine Street, which was a big market, at 12 o'clock, and he was a weird looking guy, and people looked at him, and pretty soon I was weird looking too, because I wanted to be like Philip. And so he studied French lessons a little bit, so he said to me, he gave me French words to answer back to him, as he wanted us to pretend we were two French people in this market. And so he gave us French, gave me French words to say back to him when he would say sentences. And so he'd say a sentence, and I'd absolutely screw up the response, because I think the most difficult language in the world was French. But here we are in a supermarket, two idiots, dressed bizarre, speaking French, hoping people would notice us. And that was Phil's style.
Among the many things you did was backup vocals for some of Spector's records. And you write that he used to call you his funk. Why?
Well, I have kind of a froggy voice, or I have a real nasally voice, and it cuts through everything. And so it's not a very smooth sound, but he liked it because it wasn't a smooth sound, and he thought it was funky. And it did cut through on the background. So I sang with the Blossoms and all the girls, and then later Cher joined me. And he liked that background sound, and he liked my voice in there. So when I hear the records today, Mary, I can still hear me, and so can my wife, Mary.
After working on production and promotion in the record industry, what made you think about becoming a performer yourself?
I always wanted to perform. As long as I could remember, I wanted to be in some form of show business. It's the only thing that ever really interested me. So however I could figure out a way to perform, I would try singing, but I really didn't have the pipes to be a singer. Or then I tried writing. And I just stayed in it, and I was good enough to sustain in the industry because I loved it so much that I could pull it off. So I just, as long as I could ever remember, I wanted to perform.
When you met Cher, you became a couple, and you performed together. You started off performing as Caesar and Cleo. What was the angle behind the names?
The angle then, in the 60s, you know, they had Dick and Dee Dee, chubby checker. Part of being an artist then was to come up with a gimmicky name as well. So nobody really had their real names. They always had these hook name, what we call hook names. So that was right when Cleopatra came out with Liz Taylor. And my haircut was as close, the closest thing they could call a haircut like mine then was a Caesar cut. And so, and Cleopatra was out, and I went, all right, Caesar and Cleo, that's got to be a hitting formula. What a great name. So that bombed real fast.
So when you became Sonny and Cher instead of Caesar and Cleo, how was Sonny and Cher different?
We were just a little more honest, and by then, I think I had a little more awareness after watching Phil of how to approach a commercial market and how to write for it and how to produce for it. So I was much more on as a producer and arranger and songwriter. So I wrote Baby Don't Go for Cher and with me doing the background, and it was a pretty commercial song, and I kind of felt it was right on. And when I wrote it, I left Phil, and I borrowed $135, and that's how much that record cost.
Wasn't the idea initially for you to produce Cher, but she was too nervous to sing by herself, so you ended up singing with her?
Yeah. I always wanted to. Cher wanted to sing so badly, and I always wanted Phil to record her when he was singing background, but they got along like a dog and a cat. And so he would never record her except for Ringo, I Love You. I don't know if you remember that, but that was a quick brainstorm that Philip had when the Beatles emerged on the scene.
I don't remember it.
Yeah, and he called Cher Bonnie Joe Mason. So there is a record somewhere called Ringo, I Love You by Bonnie Joe Mason, and that's Cher singing of Phil's brainstorm. And that bombed. Then I left, and I wanted to, because Phil just wouldn't record Cher, so I left, and then I wrote Baby Don't Go. And she didn't like singing alone. She was really petrified of singing in those days. She was petrified of performing, and believe it or not, she still is. And so she felt more comfortable if I was out there singing with her. So I just sang the choruses on Baby Don't Go. And it became a what we called the soft hit. It hit in California in the West Coast, but it wasn't a national hit. But it was enough to get a career rolling for us.
My guest has been Sonny Bono, and we'll hear more about Sonny and Cher in the second part of our interview on tomorrow's program. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Well, that's true, 'cause you got me, and baby, I got you. Hey, I got you, babe. I got you, babe. They say our love won't pay the rent before it's earned.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Come on over, baby, whole lot of shaking going on. Yes, I say, come on over, baby, baby, you can't go wrong. We ain't faking, whole lot of shaking going on. Well, I say, come on over, baby.
Sun Records in Memphis put out some of the greatest records in rock and roll history by performers like Jerry Lee Lewis and Elvis Presley. Coming up, we talk with Colin Escott, the author of A New History of Sun. And film critic Stephen Schiff takes a look at the new movie Boys in the Hood. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. As the leaders of the world's seven largest industrialized democracies wound up their summit meeting in London, Soviet leader Gorbachev presented his long-awaited program for Soviet economic reforms. NPR's Michael Sullivan reports from London.
President Gorbachev said the plan he brought to London would provide vital oxygen for Soviet society and said the reform process was now irreversible. British Prime Minister John Major called today's meeting a landmark event that would help the Soviet Union become a full member of the world community, and he outlined six ways in which the G7 would help the Soviets achieve that goal. They included a special association for the Soviet Union with the International Monetary Fund and World Bank to provide technical assistance, help in converting defense plants to peaceful use, developing energy resources and improving food distribution, and a commitment to expanding Soviet trade with the West. This year's chairman of the G7, Prime Minister Major, will also travel to Moscow later this year to monitor the Soviets' progress in implementing their reforms. I'm Michael Sullivan in London.
On Capitol Hill, the Senate has approved a measure that would allow federally funded family planning centers to give abortion advice. The U.S. Supreme Court has upheld a federal regulation that bans family planning clinics from giving abortion counseling. The House has approved a similar measure, which the White House says President Bush will veto. Under the bill, clinics could discuss, but not recommend, all medical and legal options to pregnancy, including abortion. Iraqi President Saddam Hussein delivered a keynote speech today attacking the West for what he called its evil and aggression against Iraq. The Iraqi leader called on his fellow citizens to unite, end their internal quarrels, and to rally behind him. Tim Llewellyn of the BBC has more.
The Iraqi leader was characteristically aggressive and outspoken in his first public statement since he was defeated in February. He said the Western aggression against Iraq had not differentiated between civilian and military targets, between young and old, between men and women. And he linked the West's physical violence against the Iraqi people, as he put it, with the continued economic embargo against his country now. On this point, he may find some support in the Arab world, hinting at what many Arabs see as Western vindictiveness against Saddam and the Arabs, hurting the people rather than the regime. His speech also called for unity among all Iraqis, presumably a reference to the Shiites of the south and the Kurds of the north. But when Saddam Hussein talks about unity, as one Western diplomat pointed out today, he means unity behind himself and his regime.
Tim Llewellyn of the BBC. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 5 points to close at 2,978 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. In Washington, the House has voted to approve legislation that would ban companies from hiring permanent replacement workers during strikes. The vote was 247 to 182. Debate had opened as the Bush administration made a new veto threat, saying the measure would damage the U.S. economy and give labor unions too much power in contract disputes. The vote in the House is short of the number needed to override a possible presidential veto. The measure is expected to face stiff Republican opposition in the Senate, where a vote could come after Labor Day. A healthy lifestyle keeps getting healthier. A study in the New England Journal of Medicine finds that regular exercise prevents the type of diabetes that afflicts roughly 10 million adults in the United States. NPR's Michael Scholar has more.
There's childhood or type 1 diabetes, often treated with insulin shots, and then there is adult or type 2 diabetes, a disease that usually hits people in middle age or beyond. Many people keep adult diabetes in control by changing their diet and by exercising. Now, a new study seems to show exercise can help prevent this type of diabetes. Researchers studied 6,000 male alumni of the University of Pennsylvania. They found that men who had a risk of developing diabetes because they were overweight or had parents with diabetes or had high blood pressure, those men could cut their risk with exercise, as little as, say, an hour a week of jogging. More exercise could cut the risk up to 40%. Exercise helps control weight, one factor in diabetes, but it also seems to improve the body's ability to break down sugar, a process that goes awry in diabetes. This is Michael Scholar in Washington.
In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved down against other currencies. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Roy Orbison, and Carl Perkins all began their recording careers at Sun Studios, a Memphis label run by Sam Phillips. The Sun sound helped define rock and roll. My guest Colin Escott has spent a lot of his life keeping those Sun records available. He catalogued Sun's master tapes and has organized many reissues, mostly for the European market. He and his old friend Martin Hawkins are the authors of the book Good Rockin' Tonight, Sun Records and the Birth of Rock and Roll. I asked Escott if he could pick one record that best represented the Sun sound.
Well, I think Mystery Train, because it was a kind of uncommercial commerciality both to the song in that the title's never mentioned in the song, which is sort of typically Sun in its way, but also the earlier version, the first version by Junior Parker, really captured the kind of bluesy feel that Phillips was drawn to, unusually so for a white Southerner. And the rock and roll version by Elvis really shows the magic that Phillips managed to draw out of Elvis Presley, or that he was the catalyst to enable Elvis to draw out of himself, whichever way you wanted to cast it.
Well, let's contrast those two versions of Mystery Train. Colin Escott, how would you describe the Sun sound? What is it that we're talking about?
I think what we're talking about is a production philosophy more than a sound. It's the assumption that feel in music is preeminent, and that the recording technology should never be an end in itself so much as a vehicle for capturing the kind of rawness and spontaneity that Sam Phillips gravitated towards, you know, that his natural ear led him towards. And in terms of sound, Sun didn't do much that hadn't come before. Phillips just had this echo that it was really poor man's echo, in that he couldn't afford an echo chamber. So what he did was to use two tape machines that he strung together and bounced the signal from one to the other, giving this kind of haunting slapback sound. It became known as slapback, which was basically the very slight microsecond delay between one machine and the other that just gave it this kind of raw, visceral quality that Phillips loved, much more intimate in a way, much more focused than the kind of cavernous chamber echo. But really, the rawness of sound enhanced by that strange echo is probably the closest you can come to defining the Sun sound.
And you can hear that echo on the Elvis version of Mystery Train.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Just a wash in it.
One of the most famous quotes attributed to Sam Phillips was, "If I could find a white boy who could sing like a black man, I could make $1 million." But sometimes that quote reads more like, "If I could find a white boy who could sing like a nigger, I can make $1 million." And a lot of people think that this is a sign of Phillips' racism. What's the story behind that quote, and is there any way of finding out which way he really said it and what he really meant by it?
Well, I mean, I think there's no evidence that Phillips was a racist, because if he were, what was he doing recording black music in Memphis in 1951? You know, that's not the hallmark of your run-of-the-mill racist. But I think what he realized was that as a rhythm and blues label, which was how Sun started out, that the demographic base that he was servicing was just too small. There was too much product in search of too few dollars, basically. And he said that by going out to the distributors and visiting the radio stations, he knew that white kids were listening to this rhythm and blues music, but he also knew that they weren't buying the records that much and they weren't going to see the artists because of the social situation in the South and in a broader context in the nation as a whole. And what his assistant said that he said over and over was that if he could find a white guy who had that feel for black music, that feel for the loose jointed swing and rhythm, that he could make himself $1 million. And he did.
And do you think that the contrast we just heard between Junior Parker and Elvis Presley illustrates how he did it?
Yeah, pretty much.
How did Sam Phillips find Elvis Presley, or how did Presley find Phillips?
Well, really, Sam Phillips didn't go out and check out the clubs and do other things that A&R men do these days. He just positioned himself in downtown Memphis, and the talent came to find him. It just came walking in off the streets, because for a lot of years he was the only game in town.
How would you describe Sun's place on the birth of rock and roll?
Well, that really depends upon what you define as rock and roll. I mean, the other day I was listening to a CD that RCA put out, which had this black gospel recording from 1928. It started off with a sermon, and then about halfway through it broke into song. And my God, I mean, that was rock and roll. It was incredible. It was 1928. So in the sense that rock and roll was the white appropriation of elements of black music and creating something new out of that hybrid, I think you can say that Presley and Sam Phillips created probably the most influential brand of rock and roll, the one that really developed into mainstream rock and roll.
If Sun Records combined a black and white sound to get a new sound of rock and roll, Sun Records also combined a rock and roll sound with country music.
That's right. I mean, for a while, in late 55, I guess, 54 and 55, all Sam Phillips blues artists had either left town or were thinking of going, and he was looking for a way to stay alive. And the most obvious option for him was to record country music, because country music was everywhere. You know, Memphis is renowned as the home of the blues, but there's been country music there as long, if not longer. And Sam was just starting to have some success with Elvis, and it was worth remembering that Elvis's success came out of the country market. I mean, when Elvis was bought by RCA, he was bought as a country musician. He wasn't bought as a pop musician. RCA certainly saw some potential for him in the pop market, but he was primarily a country musician. And Sam was also having success with Johnny Cash, Cash's first record that was doing quite well, and Carl Perkins also in the country market. So those singers, particularly Carl Perkins and Elvis Presley, brought a lot of their country music background into the mix that became rock and roll. You know, the term rockabilly really is it. You know, that's what it was. It was rhythm and blues, rock and roll music combined with hillbilly music.
Colin Escott is my guest. He's the co-author of the book Good Rockin' Tonight, Sun Records and the Birth of Rock and Roll. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about Sun Records with Colin Escott. What is Sam Phillips doing now?
Sam's nursing his investment portfolio. He he accomplished, the record business is essentially a crapshoot. It always was and it always will be. And Sam won big. And rather than reinvest his winnings in more chips, he got out and he invested his winnings in oil properties, and he was one of the first investors in Holiday Inn. He bought himself radio stations, and he's always sort of juggling the wattage and doing the other things that radio station owners do.
Now let's talk about where you enter the picture here. How did you start listening to Sun Records? When did Sun start to mean something to you?
Well, you know, in England during the late 50s and early 60s, there really wasn't that much American rock and roll music available over in England. There was Buddy Holly, Elvis Presley, a few Jerry Lewis records, one Carl Perkins record, and so on. And my friend Martin and I noticed that many of our favorite records, the Carl Perkins, Jerry Lewis, Charlie Rich, and so on, had been recorded by Sun. And they weren't released on the Sun label in England. They were released on London Records, but they had this little subscript that said recorded by Sun Memphis. That was really the beginning of it, I guess.
When did you make your first pilgrimage to Memphis?
Oh, 69, I think, 1969.
And what happened when you got there?
Sam Phillips wouldn't talk to us, but a lot of other people would.
So you went there with the idea of doing research or just...
Yeah, basically, we'd received and spent the advance from a publisher to write a book about Sun Records, and we came to town with the idea of researching it. And we obviously tried to talk to Phillips first, and he wouldn't talk to us at that point. So we just sat there in the lobby of the hotel with the phone book and going through it and comparing that to a list of Sun Records and seeing who was still in town. Surprising number were.
Are there any Sun musicians who you've been trying to track down for years and you still can't locate them?
Yeah, Elvis. I hear he's around somewhere.
I saw him the other day.
You and several others.
You ended up cataloging Sun tapes, didn't you? Like working for the company?
Well, working for them as a consultant, I guess you say, when everyone's a consultant now, I guess we were too. Sam Phillips' documentation skills weren't the greatest. Most record companies will log the tape box and say, you know, what day it was recorded and who the artist was and what the songs were and everything else. Sam's approach was a little bit different. He would finish the session and he'd put the tape away and he'd listen to it the next day and he'd put second cut real good or something on the back. Still no artist, no title, no nothing. Because, of course, he knew who it was. And, that's how a lot of the tapes have come down through the years, with little notes like that inside. So we listened to all the tapes and set about cataloging them and, just seeing what was there on behalf of the European record companies that own the rights to it, because they were anxious to get some of that product onto the market.
What made Sam Phillips talk to you this time around?
We put out a box set in England called the Sun Box, which was like an overview of what he did. And we sent him a copy. And he phoned us up and said we'd read his damn mind, was what he said to us. And from that point on, he cooperated.
How did you read his mind? I mean, what ideas of his were so in sync with yours?
He just said that we'd gone for stuff other than the obvious, and our idea of what was important from what he did meshed with his idea of what was important from what he did.
Suggest a record for us to listen to that isn't one of the obvious Sun records, but that you think is like a really important, wonderful record, and that, you know, also epitomizes the Sun sound, even though it's not very well known.
Okay, there's a record by Howlin' Wolf called Mr. Highwayman. It was done in 1951, before Sun Records started, and Phillips recorded it for Chess. But it really is a statement of his production values, and it shows everything that he would later bring to rock and roll music. It was all there in place in 1951.
Well, Colin, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Terry.
Colin Escott is the co-author of Good Rockin' Tonight.
Be careful what you're driving, man. That Cadillac may get away. You better be careful.
the highway man standing parked on the road. There's Stanley highway man parked on the road. You better watch out for the red light just before you go. Green lights to go, red lights to stop. Look at your boy, you better be on your watch. There's Stanley highway man parked on the side of the road. You better be careful about how you drive on the road. Me and my baby can ride and everything is nice to me. I'll make a cool horn and I ain't got time to stop for gas. I'll make a cool horn and I ain't got time to stop for gas. I'm gonna drive this automobile just as long as the gas lasts.
This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what do you have on the economic summit?
Well, we have news of Presidents Bush and Gorbachev reaching a strategic arms agreement in London. Also, the seven summit nations hearing out Mikhail Gorbachev's appeals for economic assistance, not offering him money, but saying that now's the time to maintain communication with the Soviet Union and to offer technical assistance in that country's move from a centralized command economy to a private free market one. Also, Tom Jelton reports on violence between Serbs and Croats in Yugoslavia, and we ask the question, when is a snack not a snack?
Thanks, Robert. Then and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Violence last weekend at showings of the movie Boys in the Hood left one dead and at least 30 wounded. But film critic Stephen Schiff says these incidents may paradoxically support the argument that violence in the movies is not what causes violence at the movies.
Actually, the anti-violence message that Boys in the Hood purveys is so strong and so all-encompassing that it weighs the picture down. Boys in the Hood can't stop preaching. It tells its black audience to get an education, to use condoms, to keep its kids out of the streets, to strive for solidarity, and most important, to discourage the meaningless gang warfare that plagues neighborhoods like the one in South Central Los Angeles, where the movie is set, and where its 23-year-old director, John Singleton, grew up. All this virtuous soapboxing, and yet the movie's opening weekend was even more explosive than the messy first weekend of New Jack City a few months ago, and the similarly troubled openings of Colors and The Warriors a few years before that. What's the link between all these movies? Not the violence in them. Any Arnold Schwarzenegger picture is 10 times as grisly without sparking shootouts at theaters. No, what these films have in common is that they're about street gangs. And why should it surprise anyone if street gang movies attract street gang audiences? I mean, do these kids have any way of relating to Dying Young or Regarding Henry? When rival street gangs congregate in a darkened, crowded theater with inadequate security, does the violence that results have anything to do with the depictions of violence on the screen? I don't think so. Boys in the Hood works overtime to quell gang violence. Fortunately, it does a lot of other things, too. The main character, 17-year-old Trey, is played by Cuba Gooding Jr., who looks a lot like the singer Al Green. He's the neighborhood's virtuous, college-bound kid, but he can't help getting mixed up with his rowdier pals across the street, especially Doughboy, a tough layabout beautifully played by the rap star Ice Cube. A lot of the movie is devoted to the usual banalities of high school life, many of which don't look much different in South Central L.A. from the way they look in Beverly Hills. Take, for instance, this scene between Trey and his foxy but prudish girlfriend, played by Nia Long.
You haven't talked to me in 5 days. I call your house and you tell your father to say you're not home. Then I call again and you take the phone off the hook.
Well, I've been busy.
Oh, well, don't give me no bald-ass excuse for a lie like that. What did I do, Trey? What did I do that was so bad that you just had to stop talking to me?
See, you know what you did? See, you gotta get with the program.
Yeah, I told you about that. I'm Catholic and it goes against my morals.
You say you wanna wait till you get married first, right? Oh, look at me, right?
Yeah.
And I say that I'm gonna be the one who marries you. So, technically, it don't make no difference whether we do it now or later. We're still gonna get married, right?
Yeah, but I wanna go to college before I get married, and there ain't no guarantee that I'm gonna marry you.
What makes Boys in the Hood feel so astonishingly fresh is the way Singleton has captured the neighborhood and its textures. The brown air, the infuriating sunlight, the low-flying planes overhead, and at night, the incessant police helicopters rattling the dishes and probing with their spotlights. Singleton makes us feel the authenticity of the world he's created more than Spike Lee ever has. The talk in this movie is ripe and funny and vigorous. The swagger of the boys and the sultriness of the girls is wonderfully palpable. And Singleton doesn't need all his preaching to expose the roots of gangland violence. He shows you how these teenagers heat up and spark just by rubbing each other the wrong way. The only difference between them and their white suburban counterparts is that when these kids blow up, they have guns. Lots of guns. Should you blame Boys in the Hood for the gang violence that attended its opening? On the contrary. See the movie, and you may begin to understand it.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Don't forget, if you have comments about Fresh Air that you'd like us to hear, we have a new toll-free listener line. The number is 1-800-NPR-WHYY. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and is performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Before reggae and ska, there was Mento. On the next Fresh Air, Mento music from Jamaica, performed in concert by the Jolly Boys. Also part two of our talk with Sonny Bono. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.